From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. 300 million people, one commander-in-chief, and in order to win the top spot, lots and lots and lots of statewide contest. First up is the Iowa caucus. Tomorrow, the contenders try to win the love and loyalty of members of their own party. And on the eve of the Iowa caucuses, recent polls show Huckabee losing his lead over Romney. Obama is leading the Democratic pack ahead of Hillary Clinton and John Edwards. For more, we've got Donna Brazil, a nationally syndicated columnist who also teaches at Georgetown University, plus Robert Trainum, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. Welcome to both of you.
Hi,
thank
Brian.
You. Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year. So who's going to get a Happy New Year tomorrow at the caucuses? What do you think, Donna?
First of all, I think the outcome is very unpredictable on both sides. The race remains very fluid. What we do know is that Senator Obama is drawing capacity crowds, but can he turn out his voters? He's relying on a lot of first-time voters, young people, independents who often side with either party, as well as people who may or may not attend caucuses in the past but may feel inspired to attend this time. It is a must-win state for John Edwards. If John Edwards fail to come in first or a close second, I don't see how Mr. Edwards can reboot his campaign. For Senator Clinton, experience has been her trump card. She has the most experienced people on the ground helping her to turn out her voters. She has a commanding lead in some polls. In other polls, she's tied like Obama for first place. So it's anyone's guess right now in terms of who will win. What we do know is that it's an exciting race. The Democrats are expecting a large turnout tomorrow night, and this race will go down to the wire.
Robert, before we turn to the Republicans, do you think that this is make or break for John Edwards?
I do believe it's make or break for John Edwards. He's pretty much has put all of his stock into Iowa. He has pretty much said that if he is able to put off a commanding lead, if you will, in Iowa, that will springboard him from a financial standpoint, but also from a political standpoint into New Hampshire and South Carolina. Look, I mean, Iowans know John Edwards. He has been around the block twice now. He was there in 2004 for obvious reasons, and he's back again in 2008. He has visited every single county. There are 99 counties in Iowa, and he recognizes that this is a make or break for him.
What about those Republicans? I mean, I want to get to Rudy Giuliani in a second, but right now let's really look at Romney and Huckabee. How are those two guys playing out their cards in Iowa?
You know, Farai, this is, I agree with Donna, this is an absolutely phenomenal campaign. You know, 2008 is already turning out to be almost like 1948, where it is just a roller coaster ride. And it reminds me of that super duper roller coaster ride at Six Flags where you laugh nervously all the way up and you scream like heck all the way down because you just have no idea where you're going to land. You're right. I mean, this is a race, frankly, between Governor Romney and Governor Huckabee. Mayor Giuliani, for the most part, is not campaigning in Iowa. He's pretty much waiting to Tsunami Tuesday on February 5th. Particularly in Florida. Huckabee recognizes that this is, frankly, his moment in the limelight, if you will. Remember, 5 months ago, no one knew who Mike Huckabee was. He was at the bottom of the polls, down there with Kucinich and Mike Gravel and some other folks. But now he has surged, and he is trying to capitalize on that surge by saying, look, I'm an outsider. I'm a former governor of Arkansas. I'm just like you. Romney, for the most part, is trying to say, look, I'm experienced. I've been on the national scene before. My father has been here many, many times before as former governor of Michigan, as well as obviously someone who ran for president back in 1968. It is really neck and neck. There's only going to be about 100,000 people, registered Republicans in the Iowa caucus, that are going to decide who the next winner will be on the Republican side. So literally, Farai, every single vote counts.
Let me also say something in terms of the Republican side, because I've had a very interesting time watching them. Look, this is a must-win for Governor Huckabee. He has to win in order to go on to the next round. He has surged late in the game, but Mitt Romney has been on the ground for many, many months. He has a terrific organization. They are layered. And perhaps the race now in Iowa is who will come in third. John McCain, who is all but left the state, has come back to try to come in third place. Fred Thompson is still in a hunt again for third place. So, while it's a must-win for Huckabee and Romney, let's look at the third-place finisher, because I think they're really fighting for the New Hampshire vote. Rudy Giuliani, there's a big show going on in Iowa, and you know what? He's waiting in the wings for Florida on January 29th and then Super Duper Tuesday on February 5th. He's gone, you know, this is like a Broadway premiere. He should show up in Iowa, and unfortunately, he will not show up until later in the season.
Farai, may I respond to that?
Absolutely.
Well, I disagree with Don in the sense where this is a make or break for Huckabee, in the sense where I think if he comes in a strong number two position in Iowa, he still is able to maintain, if you will, some of the Huckaboom is what they're calling it. I think it's a little bit different, frankly, when it comes to Romney, because keep in mind, if he loses Iowa and if he loses New Hampshire, and because McCain is surging in New Hampshire, and remember, the New Hampshire media market is in the backyard of Boston, that is really hard for Romney to maintain, if you will, some of the credibility that he is the most authoritative, the most experienced person in this race besides Mayor Giuliani. So I disagree with Donna. I do believe that if Mike Huckabee comes in second or maybe even a third in Iowa, he still is able to spring board over to New Hampshire and obviously on to South Carolina and Nevada.
I want to ask both of you guys about a couple of New Yorkers. We've mentioned Rudy Giuliani and his tactical decision to not be so invested in Iowa, but then there is the current mayor, Michael Bloomberg, who has a whole team sitting around trying to figure out if he should jump in the race. Why don't you give us, Donna, first, a little bit of a comparison of these two guys. Do you think that, first of all, the Giuliani strategy is going to work of holding off? And secondly, what do you think about Bloomberg? Is he going to throw his hat in?
Well, first, let me start with Mayor Giuliani. I think it was a mistake for him to not put some staff and some organization in Iowa and New Hampshire, because clearly, as the national frontrunner, remember, he's been leading most of the national polls, he had the most to lose if he didn't, you know, show up and compete in those early states. Now he's banking on Florida on January 29th, and that's a huge gamble, a risky gamble. If John McCain comes out of New Hampshire with a lot of momentum, McCain can go on to win Michigan, where he was strong in 2000. He can go on, perhaps, to win in South Carolina, where he has a terrific organization. And look, let's go back to this whole issue of electability. The Republicans want to win in 2008 like the Democrats, and so they're going to look for somebody who can beat the Democrats. And if you're not up there competing when everyone else is competing, it's hard for you to, you know, steal the show at the last minute. In terms of Michael Bloomberg, if both political parties nominate someone that voters like on either side, I don't see an appetite for a third-party alternative. Although there are 5 billion reasons not to count Michael Bloomberg out, because he's a billionaire, he's an attractive candidate, he's a non-politician, he's a recovering politician. I mean, he makes sense in the absence of knowing who the nominees will be. But if Democrats like their choice, Republicans like their choice, I don't see a movement for a third party candidate.
Robert?
If Michael Bloomberg gets into the race, this is Mayor Giuliani's worst nightmare. Here's why. It's because obviously there's a lot of independents out there that sway the elections one way or the other. And if, in fact, Mayor Bloomberg is in the race, The Giuliani campaign says, well, wait a minute here. That is our worst nightmare, simply because independents typically go with an independent, and a credible independent like a Mayor Bloomberg certainly will put a dent, if you will, in Mayor Giuliani's armor. Mayor Giuliani is doing a very, very risky strategy here. He's basically saying all or nothing. I want to play on the national scale, and I'm not going to belittle myself by going into Iowa and to South Carolina as well as into New Hampshire. That is a very, very risky strategy for two reasons. One, you offend Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and some other states. These are very, very fickle voters, and they're used to seeing their presidential candidates up close and personal. Secondly, it's all or nothing for Mayor Giuliani. If, in fact, he's not unable to win Florida or some of the other states, Nevada and Michigan and some other states, he is pretty much dead in the water, if you will. And that's exactly where McCain and Huckabee, for the most part, and Romney, is saying this is exactly where Mayor Giuliani is extremely vulnerable. This is his Achilles heel. He's a 300-pound gorilla right now, where he is the man on the scene. He is the one leading in the national polls. But if, in fact, these fickle voters in these individual states who ultimately decide who the nominee is going to be, if they don't like Mayor Giuliani, he's dead in the water.
Want to wrap things up with a little look at the health care bill. Over the weekend, the president signed legislation extending government-funded health insurance for children. You'll remember this was an enormous battle, vetoes and attempted overrides. Some people say this is a victory for the president. He didn't give in to Congress. He now is, in some ways, being beneficent and sort of giving out this health care, but on his terms. How do you think that that's going to play out, Donna? Is it going to help Republicans either in the presidential race or in future congressional races?
This bill has strong bipartisan support in both chambers. It's not a victory for the president. It's not a victory for the Democrats. It's a defeat for the 9 million uninsured children in this country that relies on the federal government for help in meeting their health care needs. I would hope that the president and the Democrats can find time this legislative season to work out a compromise. They're not far apart. The Democrats want to expand the program to cover more children. The president is opposed to the tax increases in the bill, which I can understand given his pledge, but this is an opportunity to help 9 million uninsured American children. This is a bill that has strong bipartisan support, and I hope that they authorize it and extend it for another 5 years and not just 3 months.
Robert?
It's a floating number out there. I mean, the president saying that 6 million people will be insured by this extension to March of 2009. The Democrats are saying that they want to extend this, or they won't stop fighting for this until 10 million people are insured. To answer your question specifically, Farai, I don't know. And I don't think anyone really knows as whether or not this is going to play in the presidential cycle, if you will. I do believe that Senator Clinton and probably Senator Edwards both have campaigned on very populist campaign platforms, if you will probably use this to their advantage, especially John Edwards. It'll be interesting to see how the Republicans play this. Probably if I am Mitt Romney or Mike Huckabee, a former governor who actually had to administer the CHIP funds, I probably would campaign on this in a positive way by basically saying, if you elect me, I will continue to work with Democrats in Congress to try to expand this program to the best of my ability, because I know firsthand how this bill helps. Look, the bottom line is that there are people out there that are uninsured, people that are living paycheck to paycheck, and a lot of these people are kids. And the fact of the matter is that the federal government does have a responsibility to insure these sick children. The only question is who's going to pay for it?
Robert and Donna, thanks so much.
Happy New Year. We're looking forward to talking to you this whole year.
Oh, yeah. We're looking forward to talking to you both.
Campaign 08, 24 hours, 7 days a week.
That's Amen. Right, babes. Donna Brazil is a nationally syndicated columnist who also teaches at Georgetown University. And Robert Trainum is D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. Just ahead on our bloggers roundtable, black lawmakers call for pardons of the Gina Six, and does going online and saying you want to date white women or black men or whatever preference mean that you're racist? This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Will internet kill the radio star? A handful of websites are giving a big assist to would-be radio jocks. All they need are a computer and a telephone. Jeffrey Bennett is the show's web producer. He joins me now to talk about it. Hey.
Hey, Farai.
So what are we talking about here technology-wise?
Yeah, well, some are calling it the future of blogging. As you said, all you need is a computer with web access and a phone, and websites like Blog Talk Radio and Skypecast are allowing amateur radio hosts to create live call-in radio shows. And like other web-enabled technology, it's relatively easy to use and it's free. The technology has been around for a while, but it's never been as streamlined and user-friendly as it is now. And the website Blog Talk Radio, for instance, they have already 46,000 shows that have been created by radio hosts.
So you can do call-in on this?
Yeah, you can link up your phone to your computer and have a show similar to ours, although not nearly as good.
Yes, not nearly as widely broadcast.
Right.
But I'm just thinking that you could do some crazy things like this, like family meeting. we're going to have a call-in family meeting.
Exactly.
Could get really ugly.
Tape it and play it back for retribution, always.
Very interesting. So also, we've been discussing the Iowa caucuses. It's a day away. How are people playing this out on our blog?
Well, we linked to an article that described the Iowa electorate as mostly white and middle-aged or old. So on our blog, people are talking about whether the idea of Iowa having the first say is outmoded. News and Views reader Aaron Larimore wrote in our blog, "There is some validity to the complaint that Iowa ought not to be such an important factor, and there is not much diversity in the caucus process. Bearing in mind as well that this is quite a small minority of Iowa voters who actually caucus, one can certainly argue that it's really a bad way to pick a nominee." So that conversation is continuing throughout tomorrow's vote.
And later on in the show, we're going to talk to two black Iowans, two of the 2.5% of the state. So we'll see what they have to say. I also understand we have resources online for folks who want to follow election news.
Right. Well, starting today on our blog, newsandviews.org, you'll be able to get updated news from the campaign trail. It's an archive of all our election-related segments, blogs from NPR's political experts, and profiles of all the candidates. And there's also some resources that let you match your views to the issues of the candidates, so you can find out who you really should be voting for based on the issues and topics.
So we have shut that door on 2007. We're looking ahead to 2008. How can our listeners join in?
We're taking 2008 predictions from our listeners and our News and Views readers. We've done some crystal ball gazing of our own and linked to some news watchers who have their predictions for the year. So anything from entertainment to politics, we want to know what people think is going to come up in the new year.
My prediction, the 2008 Bloggers Roundtables will continue to rock.
They will, indeed.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joined me from our studios at NPR West. Moving on to our Bloggers Roundtable, the great debate over Denzel Washington's new movie, A Pardon for the Gina Six, and are online dating sites racist? To give us their take, we've got education analyst and blogger Casey Lartig. His blog is The Casey Lartig Show. Also, Josen Cummings, he writes the blog Broke Thoughts on King Magazine's website. He is also the site's editor. And Mark Anthony Neal, he's a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He also writes the blog Critical Noir for Vibe Magazine online. Welcome, everybody.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So, Mark, I'm going to start with you. Denzel Washington's latest movie, The Great Debaters, is stirring up some controversy about how much it actually sticks to the historical record. Last month, we talked with Washington about the film, and he told us how he thinks film and social issues interact.
I think films reflect society. Sometimes they lead the trends, but I think basically they reflect what's going on in the world and what people are talking about and what they enjoy. Films are also escape. I remember doing a film years ago, Cry Freedom, that I thought was a very serious movie, and I felt very serious about it. And, everybody needs to see it. And a buddy of mine who's a doctor who deals with life and death issues all day long, he's like, Denzel, you know, I love you, but all day long I deal with life and death. When I go to the movies, all I want to do is eat some popcorn and forget.
So there's a question over how much people want to see a movie like this that deals with racial uplift. Then there's a question of why the film changed the setting of the great debate from Southern California, the USC campus, to Harvard. And then there, among other things, a scene where Denzel Washington, as the debate team's coach Mel Tolson, tells the story behind lynching, the Willie Lynch story. So, Mark, why don't you unpack the Willie Lynch story for us a little bit? And is it important if it's true?
I think the critical thing about the Willie Lynch story is that, you know, it's not about whether that Willie Lynch existed. You know, for all intents and purposes, many historians have weighed in on the fact that the Willie Lynch story is pretty much a myth or a hoax. I mean, William Jelani Cobb, you know, wrote a few years ago for Africana.com, you know, being very explicit about this reality. It doesn't mean that some of the logic that underlies what Willie Lynch represents, the idea of dividing folks and creating jealousies and you know, being violent against certain figures in a very public way so that it feeds down to other folks who are enslaved. I mean, the logic behind it, I think, is very useful to put out into the story. And I think, you know, if they were trying to really make a point that could stick educationally in the context of this film, it would have been helpful for Denzel Washington's character, Mel Tolson, to really discuss that story within the context of the logic as opposed to just kind of signing off on something that many folks are very clear now is basically a hoax.
So you have this story, Willie Lynch, who at least in the story is the inventor of lynching. And
right.
And it's you're arguing, if I get this right, that it's an important parable, but it's just not true.
It's just not true, right? And again, it's not unusual in the context of this film because this film does take great license with the truth throughout. You know, everything from, as you just mentioned, you know, where the actual great debate occurred, the fact that, you know, two of the three prominent characters in the fact composite figures. And in fact, those composite figures, you know, take up so much space on the screen that James Farmer Jr., who's actually, you know, the real historical figure here, really, you know, takes a back seat to them. And his narrative is critically important because it's, you know, those lessons he learned in the debate team that translate into his involvement with the founding of CORE and literally had an important political legacy that went on, you know, until his death. And we get no inkling of that in the film because so much of the film was about, you know, the feel good narrative of the year dynamic of it. You know, let's watch the little engine that could beat great big Harvard, you know, in a debate.
Yeah, James Farmer Jr., founding the Congress of Racial Equality. But sorry, go ahead, jump in.
Yeah, this is Casey. I want to say I think it's actually tragic that they used the Willie Lynch letter, which or speech. I mean, it's a piece of fiction. There's no need to exaggerate bad things that have gone on in Black history. There's no need to bring in something that's clearly an urban legend when you're doing a story that is based on at least some truth. So actually, I think it was a mistake that they did. I mean, there's so many of these urban legends out there that make people paranoid, and maybe people have, you know, should be paranoid. But why bring in some fiction?
What about the whole idea that you can mix these composite characters with a real character like James Farmer Jr.? Is it okay to put characters that are like historical characters on par with characters who actually lived and breathed?
I think it's acceptable. You should be allowed to have some creative license. People shouldn't use Hollywood and movies as their history teacher. If you are letting these movies, if you're letting these movies teach you something and you take their word as gold, then you have a real problem. They shouldn't be your primary source of knowledge. A movie like The Great Debaters should pique your curiosity, not necessarily satisfy it.
Yeah, so, but you know, we got a problem. For on a lot of Black talk radio, we have a lot of these urban legends being peddled. So we got it now in a Hollywood movie, and I'm sure we have a lot of other places where these things. So yeah, it's not a bad idea to kind of mix these things in. But I start to worry when it's like, well, you know, the truthiness of it is okay. We can just kind of bring these things in. Actually, I say it's a mistake to bring this particular thing in.
Josen, what about the whole idea of what people want to see, Black, white, or purple people? You know, you have this movie, Great Debaters, making only a quarter of the amount per screen in its opening mm-hmm. weekend as mm-hmm. I Am Legend, the Will Smith zombie mm-hmm. movie. That basically means, you know, regardless of how many theaters they're playing in, and I Am Legend is playing in more, people really went out to see I Am Legend, and they mm-hmm. went out, but not as hard or not as fast to go see The Great Debaters.
Right.
Are people
right.
just more interested in escapism? That's kind of what Denzel Washington was saying.
I think so. I think that I believe that there's such a thing as Black Hollywood and a Black film, and I think The Great Debaters is such a film. Most Black films aren't made with allusion to grandeur. Studios don't expect a Black film to amass out of this to amass like world breaking box office numbers. They expect a Black film to be popular within its own community. So I think when we're talking about the success of The Great Debaters, we need to look beyond the box office numbers. I really do believe that Oprah and Denzel are happy with the fact that they were able to tell this story and release it. It's a so-called passion project. When Denzel did American Gangster, which did open at $43.6 million opening weekend, he was appearing on the cover of Entertainment Weekly with Russell Crowe. With The Great Debaters, he's appearing on the cover of Ebony with Oprah. So you look at something like that and you realize that for them, this wasn't about making as much money as they possibly can. Rather, this was about being able to use their star power to get the kind of movie they want to see made. So you really, I mean, yes, I'm sure the studio execs are concerned with the box office numbers and everything, but you really have to look beyond that as just being a definitive sign of success.
Mark, let's go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, you know, the reality is that, you know, it is a historical period film, which don't do well unless, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio is starring in it. And I think, you know, the filmmakers tried to make some concessions. I mean, the relationship between Nate Parker's character, and Samantha Book, you know, that was the kind of character and the kind of focus on the sexual tension between them that they hoped would bring young audiences to the film.
All right, guys, got a couple more things I want to get to. We're going to have to take a quick run through them. Mark, 14 members of the Congressional Black Caucus sent a letter to the Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco asking her to pardon the Gina Six. Now, at the time that Gina Six was really raging publicly, particularly the Michael Bell case, there was some criticism of the Congressional Black Caucus that they didn't ask for enough. Is now the right time? Too late? Is this still important to ask for a pardon?
I think for them, they got back to their hometowns and got back to their constituents, and their constituents called them on the fact that they weren't very vocal and aggressive enough around the Gina 6. The reality, though, is that I think this really is an effort for them to do something very publicly to respond to their constituents. And while I think, you know, it's something that they're passionate about and it's something that they really feel powerfully about, the reality is that there are so many other black political prisoners, many of which have been incarcerated because of things like COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program at J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, that really need to be dealt with. And the fact that, you know, they're not really putting feet to the ground to deal with, quote unquote, legitimate political prisoners, and instead are spending time on Gina 6 to respond to the constituents.
Right.
Casey, yeah. do you agree?
Yeah, for the most part. And I'll just say I'm kind of suspicious of these things that get labeled while they're still going on. I mean, Gina 6, I mean, history will determine this. But while it's going on, it's just, you know, I mean, it's got more like, I don't know, like a sports update the way it was. So,
right. I think the thing with the CBC is that, I mean, I'm disappointed that they're using their power of persuasion on Governor Blanco solely for the Michael Bell and the Gina 6 case. I mean, this is a governor of Louisiana who probably has some other important issues pertaining to the black community. Like, I don't know, the after effects of Hurricane Katrina. I mean, we could be going after them. They should be talking to the governor about all things pertaining to the state of Louisiana, if that's the case, not just this Gina 6 case.
Yeah, you know, and that's the tragic thing about it. The truth is now, when people see Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and others hustle down to somewhere, now it's more like, there must be something else to this story.
Right.
Okay, right. There's got to be more than, I mean, because for those guys to show up, that's like getting a call from Jerry Springer. This just can't be good.
You guys are a mess. Now, all right, we have very little time for this last topic. I was hoping to dig in because it's something that has been becoming much more common, people finding their life mates or at least their night's dates through online dating. And Josen, you are at King Magazine, which could be certainly called Bootylicious. So if somebody goes onto an online dating site and says, I only want black men, or I don't want black women, or I only want Asian women, is that racist? What do you think?
I don't think that's racist. In no, it's not racist. It's more a matter of preference. That's a personal thing. Who you want to date is a personal thing, and I believe that our dating lives, every individual dating lives, should be exempt from so-called political correctness.
We just
need to be able to express ourselves, because if we're taking this outside of cyberspace and we're gonna talk about our dating habits and how we go out and search for people. If a black man prefers to date black women, he is only going to those clubs, those spots where he will find black women. And he has a preference for that sort of thing. And that's not necessarily racist.
No, all right. Exactly. This is Casey. See, those are personal ads. I mean, this is not Bill 467823. I mean, right. It's a personal thing. If you are a black woman who's into Korean men, sister, more power to you. You're not wasting the time of brothers, you know, trying to pass their lines onto you. There's no affirmative action in dating or marriage, nor should there be. And we should just let people be on themselves to do what they want to do.
All right, Mark, look, real quick.
Look, I've been married for 17 years, right? So I'm not into online dating. But the reality is that, you know, I'm looking for a grown-ass woman with a big booty, if I was. And I would say that explicitly.
Okay.
And there's no reason to, you know, not to say that explicitly. If I'm going to say that explicitly, I'm also going to say the racial dynamic of who I'm willing to date also.
All right. Well, Mrs. Neal will be calling us immediately. Thank you, God.
What did he say about me?
I said, Mrs. Neal will be calling us. She'll be like,
that's what she'll be saying. What did he say about me?
She'll be like, what did my husband say? Anyway, Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He also writes Vibe Magazine's blog, Critical Noir. He was at Duke University Studios. Education analyst and blogger Casey Lartigue's blog is The Casey Lartigue Show. He was at NPR's HQ in Washington, D.C. And Josen Cummings writes the blog Broke Thoughts on King Magazine's website. He is also the site's editor. He was at NPR's New York studios, and you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. Today we begin a new series called In Character. For the next 6 months, NPR will explore the origins and impact of famous fictional characters, from Bugs Bunny to Uncle Ben. To kick off the series here on News and Notes, we're going to take a closer look at a character created by the legendary Richard Pryor.
When I was little, there was an old man, his name was Mudbone, and he dipped snuff, and he'd sit in front of the barbecue pit, and he'd spit. See, that was his job. I'm pretty sure that was his job, because that's all he did.
Like all great fictional characters, Mudbone has a lot to tell us about ourselves. Here's commentator William Jelani Cobb with a tribute to Richard Pryor's Mudbone.
Way down on the dirt roads of American culture, they have a saying that every shut eye ain't sleep. It wasn't invented to describe Mudbone, but it should have been. Equal parts wino and wise man, Mudbone served as Richard Pryor's comedic alter ego, a figure who told the straight, high-octane truth, but masked it inside humor. He was, in essence, that older relative who has reached an age where he feels he can say anything without consequences.
I was born in P.O., Illinois.
What's that?
That's a city. You probably wouldn't know nothing about that, see? Old country, boy.
Richard Pryor may have built the character on memories of a street corner philosopher in his native Peoria, but it was clear from the start that Mudbone was meant to be a slightly tipsy everyman whose double vision gave him insights that the sober couldn't see. He spoke in a salty, inebriated diction that stretched words until it seemed he had created a new set of vowels.
I worked for this white man, his name was Bud Jennings. And I worked for, he was all right to work for, see? He was all right for a white man, he wasn't bad, see? But he had a son named Junior, he was cockeyed. We called him Cockeyed Junior. And he was hard to work for, man, because his eyes went every which way, see? He said, pick that up, you know, and four or five n***s been down, see?
Mudbone tossed around N-words and B-words, D-words, P-words, and adjectival variations of the F-word. But there was a lot more to him than cuss words. Inside his foul-mouthed parables was a layer of meaning that was as profound as it was hilarious. In one particularly ironic instance, Mudbone talks about working on the crew of the 1915 film Birth of a Nation, where he witnessed director D.W. Griffith stealing film ideas from his black assistant.
So, you know W. Griffith, he invented the close-up, right? And the reason was Birth of a Nation, see? He was doing the movie, I was working on it. And the gave him the idea for a close-up. Ain't gonna get no credit for it. Said, hey, Mr. Director, see that big nose over there? Why don't you put the camera right up close to his and get his face all over the screen, see? You gonna make you some money with that face, see?
If Mudbone couldn't be taken at his word, his stories managed to be true, even when they weren't factual. He tells of being slapped by a white woman back in Mississippi. As revenge, he saws out most of the flooring in the outhouse and then waits for her to answer nature's call. When he hears a splash, he gets in his tractor and heads to Peoria. On its face, this is a comic tale, but beneath it, Mudbone is really riffing on the racial dynamics of the Great Migration. The truth is that the humiliation and disrespect Mudbone described were among the primary reasons that nearly 2 million African Americans left the South during the first half of the 20th century. Having reached a certain age, Mudbone was not unaware of his own significance, telling one audience,
"You don't get to be old being no fool." So, a lot of young wise men, they're dead in the m***.
Later in Pryor's career, Mudbone became a sort of mouthpiece, giving a running op-ed not only on American history and culture, but also the comedian's own demons. And live on the Sunset Strip, Pryor's first performance after he set himself on fire while freebasing cocaine, Mudbone tells of how much he admires his friend Richard Pryor, but just can't get the comic to stop abusing drugs. Mudbone tells Pryor that if religion isn't his thing, ballet might help him kick the habit, and tells the audience that he won't have that kind of problem because, quote, "I'm still hungry." And if Mudbone was still hungry, we knew that the best portion of Pryor was still intact.
William Jelani Cobb is a professor at Spelman College and the author of To the Break of Dawn, a freestyle on the hip-hop aesthetic. In Character, our series exploring famous fictional American characters, continues on News and Notes later this month with an examination of Jim from Huck Finn. You can learn more about the series at npr.org. Earlier in the show, we talked about the Iowa caucuses. African Americans are only 2.5% of the state's population, but don't let the numbers fool you. Black leaders in the Hawkeye State are determined to have their say. Today, we've got two Black Iowans to talk about the state of the state. Leon Mosley is co-chair of the Iowa Republican Party, and Abraham Funches is the director of the Iowa Commission on the Status of African Americans. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello. Yeah. So good to be here.
Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year's. Abraham, let me start with you. You are directing this state commission on African Americans. First of all, where do Black Iowans live? Mainly in a couple of cities or spread out across the state?
Right. Good question. But for the most part, over half of Iowa's Black population live in three cities primarily: Des Moines, Waterloo, and Davenport. And of course, the city with the largest Black population is Waterloo, with 14% Black.
So what about these key issues? What's really on your mind as you look at Black communities in Iowa?
There are several, actually. Right now we have the OCBI initiative, the Ongoing Covenant with Black Iowa, and we're looking at several issues: education, youth development, economic development, political involvement, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, with the latest news, as we talk about Black incarceration and suspensions and expulsions from school, those take precedence, obviously, education as well as criminal justice issues.
Give us a little bit more of a taste of what specifically you're talking about with incarceration.
Well, right. Even though we represent about 2.5% of the entire state population, we represent about 26-27% of those in the prison population in the state of Iowa. And, of course, that's alarming to us, as it is for everyone else in the nation, quite frankly. And in order to address those kinds of issues, we have to look, obviously, at education, what's going on there, why the breakdown. We believe the increased expulsions and suspensions are closely related to the problems associated with the other criminal justice issues. And this is something that we have decided to try to tackle using a comprehensive model called the Ongoing Covenant with Black Iowa Initiative, which moves people in various parts of the state to not only talk about the problems, but begin to propose solutions to those problems, and then attach a budget to it. So what we're looking at with the OCBI initiative right now is that we are looking to shift the conversation from talking about our pain to our plan, which is something Tavis Smiley has been touting a lot. And, of course, attaching a budget to it, coming up with policy development, and then legislative implementation.
Leon, it sounds like there's some serious issues that are on the table. What would be your plan for addressing them? What would you like to see the Republican Party do, or what would you like personally to happen around issues of incarceration, of education?
Well, when you stop and think about it, it goes all the way back to the home. And ever since our home environment has been demoralized and you can't hardly spank your kids anymore without you going to jail, so I, far as I'm concerned, when I look at my state of Iowa, and you stop and think about 2.5% of the population and 26-27% are in prison, you have to work hard to go to prison. They just don't send you there the first time. You have to do something over and over and over again to the people just say, hey, enough's enough. And as far as the Black community is concerned, I'm outraged that we keep talking about it. There's three types of people in this world: those that make things happen, those that let things happen, those that don't know what's happening. And unfortunately, we do a lot of talking. We're the best talkers in the world, but when it comes up to get up and talk about doing something, we are the last to get up.
When you think about, you mentioned issues of the home, but what do you believe the role of government is? Because that's been something that in recent years has been a defining question between the two parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. How much should government solve problems that some people ascribe to, you know, personal behavior, personal responsibility? In Iowa, how much would you like to see the next president of the United States take responsibility for dealing with issues like racial justice, like education?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, the first thing I would like to see, I'd like to see smaller government, and I want government to get the heck out of my life. If they get out of my life, I can make it, and I can raise my kids like they need to be raised. And my dad whooped my butt when I'd done something wrong. The neighbors whooped my butt, and I'm not in prison. I don't do drugs, and I understand what life's all about. I mean, when I wake up in the morning and look in the mirror, I don't see a white guy standing there. I see Leon Mosley looking in the mirror. And the thing that I have a challenge to do is, what can I do to help make this a better, safer place without blaming everybody for something? I just don't believe in blaming anybody for anything. I've been all across this state. I've been in parts of this state where there wasn't even a black dog in town. But let me tell you something. I never had a problem, because I go there to treat people like I want to be treated. I'm not going there and demanding anything, asking anything. And if anything government can do is talk about a hand up and not a hand out. That's what just irks me.
Abraham, when you think about the lives of people in Iowa, in a mm-hmm. state which is more rural than America as a whole, sure. has less people of color than America as a whole, that has a specific character that has permeated American politics because of its position for years. How important is it for Black Iowans to try to get out some kind of a conversation about what communities are facing? Is this just, I'm trying to do this delicately, should people care?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the condition for Black folk in Iowa right now is perilous, to put it mildly. And it's imperative that we do the very best we can through agencies such as the one I have the privilege of directing at this particular time to give voice to Black Iowa. As a matter of fact, I'm legislatively mandated to be the Black voice for Iowa. And as we continue to push the OCBI initiative, which is an ongoing covenant with all of Iowa, we are asserting that to make Black Iowa better necessarily makes all of Iowa better. And while we do believe in the importance of assuming accountability and responsibility for actions that go on within the Black population, we at the same time emphasize that government does have to play a huge role in terms of correcting the disparities that are present within Iowan society. The disparity in education, the disparity in terms of Black incarceration, these high expulsion and suspension rates that are going on in school, are not just happening in a vacuum or a colorblind society. The reality is that the variable of race plays a big role in a lot of the policy construction that goes on in Iowa. And indeed, we want exactly what Mr. Mosley was talking about, not a hand out, but a hand up. And so the emphasis is on really coming up with proposed solutions to the problems, so that we can continue to advocate for the kind of fiscal funding we need in order to correct those problems.
Do you think that you're hearing people who are politicians, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, speaking to the issues you're talking about, Abraham?
In some places, we're very optimistic. I mean, after all, the OCBI initiative was very fortunate to receive some funding because of legislators that crossed the aisles, Republicans and Democrats, Black and white. So we're optimistic that people are beginning to appreciate the need to do something about it. And we think that that happened in part because we had a plan. We're talking less about our pain and beginning to put emphasis on a plan, while at the same time, we know we are continually fighting an uphill battle. While we're optimistic about some of the situations that are happening nationally in terms of the way people are responding to some of the politicians, it suggests that America's coming to a point, Iowa's coming to a point where it's coming to grips with itself as we talk about war, race, poverty, etc. But we know it's an ongoing battle. Nothing's going to change overnight, and we have to make sure that we have all of our ducks in a row.
Leon, are you hearing from politicians? I know that you're strongly affiliated with the Republican Party, but are you hearing from Republicans or Democrats anything that speaks to you?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, not really.
Not even really. From Republicans?
Well, when you start talking about the home, who's talking about the home? We're talking about wars, and we're talking about Iraq, we're talking about everything, but we're not talking about – and see, you got to understand something. When you start talking about giving somebody something, when government gives you something, there are strings attached. Mm-hmm. That's why I just wanted government to leave me alone. I chase drug dealers all over the state of Iowa. I don't ask for one dime from the government because I know they're going to have strings on it. They're going to tell me where to go, when to go, how to go. And if I spend my own money doing it, I can go where I want to and do what I want to and stay long as I want to and don't care who cares about it long as I get the job done.
So this is in your other hat, not in your hat as the co-chair of the Iowa Republican Party.
Right.
Well, in general, I guess where I'll leave it, Leon, is what do you hope to see emerge out of this caucus in terms of not just for this one day, but in general, putting these issues that you've talked about, like incarceration, like educational attainment, on the table?
Well, with me, a lot of people have asked me who should they support and vote for and this and that. My attitude to the Republican Party is, as co-chair of the Republican Party, and I must add and tell you, I'm the highest black in the history of the state of Iowa in any party. Now, does that say a lot? And I got one foot on a banana peel, another one in the graveyard. But I'm saying this to you. We need to look at what we can do for ourselves and stop depending and counting on government to do anything for us. I am so tired of people talking the talk, but they won't walk the walk. How many politicians have we sent to Washington, D.C.?
Well, gentlemen,
only to feel bad about it.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to end it there. I want to thank you both so much. Speaking with Leon Mosley, Iowa Republican Party co-chair from KUNI in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Also, Abraham Funchess. He spoke with us from our election studios in Des Moines, Iowa. And that's our show for today. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, the moment of truth in Iowa. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Maybe upon a broken guitar.